The San Diego Housing Federation's annual Ruby Awards is the county's largest affordable housing community recognition event. They'll honor the best people, projects, and achievements from the past year. Join the awards on June 6th at the Marriott Marquis San Diego Marina. Early bird pricing is available until April 12th. Secure your tickets today at housingsandiego.org. That's housingsandiego.org. This podcast is brought to you in part by the estate of Bob Nelson. Bob was a lover of all things San Diego and a longtime supporter of Voice of San Diego and its podcasts. We at Voice of San Diego are honored to have his support during his lifetime and continued support through his estate planning. This podcast is sponsored in part by Intesa Communications Group, a women-owned PR and government relations firm that helps you communicate and advocate with confidence. Intesa colleagues are deeply ingrained in the issues and communities you care about most. From universities and nonprofits to corporate developers, theme parks, and tech titans, Intesa helps thoughtful leaders from all sectors shape San Diego for the better. Learn more at IntesaCom.com.
Okay. Ready? You guys want to do the podcast? I'm so excited
all I do.
To be with you.
That's all I do. I'm
excited to be with you too, Scott. Kind of.
I never know if you guys are like kidding.
All right. Voice of San Diego podcast, January 20th, 2022. 3, 2. Welcome to the Voice of San Diego podcast in partnership with News Radio 600 KOGO. I am Scott Lewis, the CEO and editor-in-chief at Voice of San Diego. And I'm joined, as always, by managing editor Andrew Keats.
Scott, how are you, pal?
I'm good. I feel good. And managing editor, also managing editor Andrea Lopez Villafana. Hello.
Hello.
How are you, Lopez?
Doing good. Happy to be here.
Me too. We are in the studio again. We're back. It's been a rough month. 2020. Two, what is it?
What year?
That's the appropriate year. In fact, that's how I'm going to sign my checks for the rest. 2020 dot 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 two question mark will be how I sign my checks this year.
Coming up on the show this week, some major news in law enforcement as the region's top cop, Sheriff Bill Gore, announced he's retiring early. What a shock. Never seen that before. So what happens now, and what does it mean for the race to replace him? We'll break it down. And last week, Andrea and I talked about the comments from San Diego Mayor Todd Gloria during his State of the City speech about how he wants to force more mentally ill San Diegans into conservatorships. This week, we got more reporting done on that topic, and we can explain it a little bit more deeply. And finally, the trash strike is over. Sanitation workers are back on the job, and soon places like Chula Vista and other parts of San Diego will see those piles of garbage cleaned up. The workers and the company faced immense pressures, and our Jesse Marks wrote about it in his column about the pressures that everyday San Diegans face. And Marks is going to join us to explain. That's all coming up. Stay with us. My confusion about what year it is struck again.
Yeah.
So yesterday the news came out that Sheriff Bill Gore was retiring. And I'm like, well, we knew that.
Yeah.
Because somebody was going to run for sheriff and that it would be effective February 2022. And in my mind, it didn't click that that was this year.
It was like a few weeks
ago. I thought
it
was just like, oh, well, yeah, that's the year that he'll be done. Why are we even getting this news?
Like, duh. Yeah. Slow news day.
Yeah. Come on, man. You already made this clear. What do you want more? Like, it's like when they launch campaigns like more than once, you know?
Yes.
They're like, this is the real launch.
Yeah.
But turns out that's this year. That's in the next couple weeks. And Sheriff Bill Gore is going. Now, the obvious interpretation of why he would do that is why his predecessor did it.
And why the current district attorney's predecessor did the same thing.
Yeah.
Vacating her job.
Yeah. Bill Colander left his job.
It's a playbook for this at the county, for these countywide seats.
Yeah. Bill Colander, longtime sheriff, San Diego, left his job before the election. allowing Bill Gore to be appointed to the sheriff's seat, you know, temporarily,
yeah,
and then run for the office as the sheriff.
And it says underneath his name on the ballot, sheriff.
Yeah.
Which
is powerful.
Awfully valuable.
Same thing happened with Bonnie Dunamanis. She left. She says, I'm going to resign. I'm going to resign early. She maneuvered it so that her top deputy, Summer Steffen, could be appointed to the seat. And then Summer Steffen got to run as quasi-incumbent.
Right.
So is that what's happening?
No, by all accounts. It's a little curious why this has to happen right now. If that's not going to happen?
Yeah, he didn't say, I'm sick. Yeah. I want to go to Greece.
Yeah. Yeah.
People go to Greece when they retire.
I don't know. It seems like I would do that.
Lovely
like
area.
A, yeah. He's got a giant pension. Now he can go to a lot of places.
Right. But no, he's not. And so Nathan Fletcher, the chairman of the board, has said that we will not appoint anyone who is running for the office.
Well, he said he...
Okay,
would not support doing that. He said, quote, the previous board of supervisors had a habit of appointing their chosen candidate for countywide offices very close to an election. I didn't think it was right for them, and it would not be right for us. So, Andrea, we have two candidates we know who are running. There's three, actually. We had them at PolitiFest. Kelly Martinez, his top deputy, the undersheriff, she's running. And then Dave Myers is running for that seat as well. He was a former sheriff for a long time.
And he ran in 2018 for the same position.
And then San Diego City Attorney, the head of the criminal division in the misdemeanors office of the San Diego City Attorney, John Hemmerling, former Marine, he's running as well.
And all three of the Democrats on the County Board of Supervisors, the people who have appointed Nathan Fletcher as the chair, have all endorsed Kelly Martinez.
Mm-hmm.
So
they did that the moment she announced that she was running, and the moment that Bill Gore announced he wasn't.
Yes. At a time when not a lot of people knew who Kelly Martinez was. And so it was natural early on to wonder whether this was whether the path they were going to go down was the path that they had gone down before with both Gore and Dumanis.
Yeah. So here we have Nathan Fletcher saying even though he supports Kelly Martinez, he's not going, or he doesn't want to put her right into that seat. But that does not necessarily eliminate the possibility that his colleagues, two Republicans and the two Democrats on the County Board of Supervisors, could decide when this decision is made that they do want Martinez.
Right, because they've already said that they're supporting her.
Right.
But Kelly Martinez issued a statement saying, I will not pursue the appointment. And then this was a statement she put out. I saw Andrew Bowen was tweeting about it, and a lot of people responded to him. Sure. But will she reject the appointment if it was given to her? Is she trying to weasel word this by saying, I don't want that, but does that leave some sort of room for her to be appointed and to accept it after the fact? And
you have to apply, right?
And she, yes, you do have to apply. At least that's my memory on the district attorney situation a few years ago. But she clarified, look, make no mistake, I'm not doing this. So look, things change, but people are going to have to get awfully creative about how to make this one go if they're trying to make it happen after all the doors they've closed in the last day, right?
And I guess I have a question for you guys since I don't remember this last time it happened.
Mm-hmm.
The point that Nathan Fletcher is trying to make, isn't that something that people were arguing back then when Gore was appointed?
Yeah, I mean, it was like this kind of dog and pony show, right? They just were very clearly pulling something off.
Yeah.
And no matter how much you shouted about it, they'd be like, well, yeah, but nobody cares.
Right.
Keep shouting, nerd. Like, you know.
Well, it's like the least amount of political science you need to know to understand local races is that absolutely nothing that happens in a campaign is more important than what is on the ballot. Nothing.
Yeah.
No amount of money spent, no amount of endorsements you collect, no amount of campaign narrative that plays out in the press or in debates is ever going to reach the wide swath of people that will be presented with the job title of the person on the ballot.
That's why I remember when Kevin Faulkner ran for governor and there was a big fight because he wanted to be known as former mayor of San Diego, but you can't be a former anything on the ballot, which is stupid. Like, that's the best way to identify him is to say he's the former mayor. But instead, he had to go by what, businessman?
Yes, businessman.
He's
which,
literally
as we reported,
done nothing
he's
in
like,
business.
No, he's got a LLC that has like two clients. and so in all these elections, there's like these lawsuits and people try to drum up coverage that, you know, campaign consultants try to drum up coverage for their fights about why their opponent's ballot title is grossly inaccurate and their ballot title is grossly unfair and blah, blah, blah. It happens every cycle. But like there was no mystery with Bill Gore or with Bonnie DeMantis that when they Summer Steffen, that when they were appointed into this interim position that for the same job that they were running for, that it was immensely valuable, more valuable than anything else that was going to happen in an entire campaign. And so it, you know, raises a reasonable question about how fair that campaign that follows it is.
Yeah. And I think it's probably, I think it's almost 80% that that's still what Bill Gore is trying to do or facilitate.
Well, just without any other information, I don't understand
why
he is trying.
Why
do
you need to leave a year early? Now, a couple of other developments we haven't talked about in that race. So this is probably the marquee race of the county in 2022, I would say. There's Chula Vista mayors, a couple other things that are pretty interesting. But one interesting moment. So all those Democrats endorsed Kelly Martinez when she came out because they were trying to block Dave Myers from this. He's seen as more of an activist, reformist, right? Criminal justice advocate. And so he did get overwhelmingly the support of the Democratic Party. And so I remember the Democratic Party was all kind of miffed with us because when we said like Dems try to, you know, block out Dave Myers and support Kelly Martinez. Yes, there were several prominent Democrats who did that, but the actual party now has rallied behind Myers.
And if nothing else, that's revealing of we'll see how that plays out in its significance in this race, but we don't actually have to see how anything plays out to say that that reveals some significant split between where the party is and the activists that make up its central committee that vote on endorsements and the elected elected members of the party in the San Diego Democratic Party.
Who are also very unfiltered about their disdain for Myers. I mean,
or at least a few of them.
Yeah, know. Like Juan Vargas called him unhinged, a congressman. Like,
yeah, but kind of didn't tough. Specify any details about like what he didn't like about Dave Myers.
Right. So,
but I thought one thing I thought was when in Kelly Martinez's comments in the statement she made, you've got him
got
there
right here. The people of San Diego deserve a fair race for sheriff, as well as an appointment process they can trust.
I mean, I just don't see any sort of way you can read that except to say that the district attorney for this county was not elected through a fair process and she was appointed through a process that the people of San Diego cannot trust.
That's Damn. One way to read that.
I don't see any alternative way to read it.
Yeah.
A couple weeks ago, our Jesse Marks launched a new column called Fine City, and it's about the struggles and the stories of people who are trying to make it work here in San Diego. I'm already a fan. What do you think, Andrea? Pretty good, right?
I'm a big fan. Great name.
So this week, Marks has written about the sanitation workers' strike in mostly South Bay. Obviously, Republic Services served most of the county, though, in different ways. And the sanitation workers who were on strike faced a tremendous amount of pressure, as his column explains. Very interesting insight to what they were dealing with and why the strike was ultimately resolved. Jesse joins us. Hey, Jesse.
Hey, Scott. What's going on?
Much. Just here. Sharing aerosols in the studio. Let's start here. Your column is about the immense pressure the workers face. What pressures did they face as this strike went on? Obviously, people are getting mad about their trash everywhere. the city councils and mayors are issuing stern statements. what was going on in their mind?
Well, I think the pressure came from a lot of different directions, but there was plenty of support that the workers got from the city of Chula Vista. Everything I heard, at least in the public record to date, was actually fairly sympathetic to the workers and their position. And even people who are getting up and commenting on these things are basically saying, look, this isn't the fault of the workers that they're on strike. They're demanding better wages and they have a right to do it. But I think the pressure was primarily coming from a couple of different angles. It was partly external, but it was partly internal as well. And that's because strikes are really hard work. The union members have to stay off the job to hold themselves to a collective cause. But as I started discovering when I went to the picket line over the last week or so, was that some of the guys had crossed that line. And then on top of that, the company had started bringing in outside workers to clean up trash in the streets in response to all the complaints that had been generated. So they were literally being replaced, if only temporarily. But then more importantly, my column focuses on the fact that there was an unofficial deadline that was looming over the heads of a lot of the union members. And it was based on one of the terms in their previous contract. So if they waited too long, they were at risk of losing their health care. And that's because they're contractually obligated to work 80 hours a month, which meant even though they went out on strike on December 17th, healthcare and health insurance was secured for the month of January, but it wasn't secured for the month of February unless they got on the job. So if you need to work 80 hours, that's roughly 2 weeks, which meant that this past Monday was a kind of unofficial deadline that was looming over their heads to get a deal done or to go back on the job.
Yeah, so they had negotiated their own strike deadline in a way in the previous contract.
They did, and I don't have any sense that they were fully cognizant of that at the beginning, but I can tell you that these guys didn't think the strike would actually last that long. There was a previous strike initiated by a different group of Teamsters up in Orange County late last year, and so they took their cue and they took their inspiration from that strike because that one only lasted 8 days and it was resolved fairly quickly. So the guys I spoke with were basically telling me, we thought this would last only a couple of days. And then when it bled into the course of an entire month, I think this panic started to set in. And I was going to these rallies that the union was holding with its own membership. And they were openly talking about, hey, you guys, we know that there's some talk of people wanting to cross the picket line. Just please don't do it. So there was a certain desperation that kind of crept in at the last minute. And I think that's what pushed them over the edge to sign a deal that they weren't totally in favor of, but the alternative was so much worse.
So in the end, compare the deal they got with the deal in Orange County that they sort of were hoping to get and whose sort of the path they were following in striking in the first place.
So these guys have a base rate of $24.60 an hour. And so what they wanted was a $6 increase over the course of the next 5 years, which it's my understanding that's what the guys up in Orange County got. And instead, the company came back and said, we'll give you a $4.90 increase over the next 5 years. And even though that's a 20% increase over their hourly base pay, it still wasn't good enough for them because a region like San Diego is so expensive. So a lot of these guys were telling me, if you do the math, $24.60 an hour comes out roughly to about $50,000 a year. Some of them are able to make upwards of $75,000, but that requires you to put in 60 hours a week, which means typically 6 days a week. And that's a pretty grueling schedule for a lot of these guys. And they've also pointed out how dangerous their jobs can actually be. But more importantly, and completely understandably, they'd like weekends off to be with their families.
Yeah. And so with the soft deadline, or I guess it honestly turned into a bit of a hard deadline with the need to lock up healthcare, how much did whatever leverage the city of Chula Vista and the city of San Diego through the Mayor Todd Gloria's statements late last week, how much did those actions end up mattering in terms of putting leverage on the negotiations, or really in the end, was it all about this deadline for healthcare?
My impression of it was that the company was largely unfazed by the threats that were coming out of the city of Chula Vista and the city of San Diego. And just so people understand, The Teamsters Local 542 has a collective bargaining agreement that expands across a couple of different cities. So even though Chula Vista was the heart of the labor dispute, it affected and disrupted routes in the unincorporated part of the county, as well as in the city of San Diego. And I think initially the response from the workers in the face of these comments from the mayor's office, from the kind of public grilling that the Chula Vista City Council gave to the management of Republic Services, that was greeted with a lot of enthusiasm and excitement. But it was also quite telling that immediately afterwards, the company didn't return to the negotiating table. And so from the perspective of the workers, they just assumed that this company, because it's so big, because its profits in 2020 were more than $1 billion, that they could afford to just wait this out as long as possible. Because in the back of their minds, they knew that there was an unofficial deadline approaching and that many of these guys needed to keep their health insurance. And so there was an incentive for them eventually to cave.
Jesse, why do you think this played out differently than what happened in Orange County? I mean, you wrote about it last week. You mentioned some issues with the contract in the city of Chula Vista.
I think it's in large part because the strike up in Orange County had more official support, or at least official support more quickly. The city of Huntington Beach declared a public emergency within a couple of days. Chula Vista waited an entire month to do that, and in the process just wound up buying time indirectly for the company to just wait these guys out. So I think, as well-meaning as the responses were from the city of Chula Vista and San Diego, I think it was too little too late by then.
That's a really interesting point, because I think when I look at all the statements that were put out and all the again, stern, you know, written statements, they were always very kind of ambiguous, like, you need to pick up trash. People need to get back to work. You know, there need. It was never like it. You know, and obviously they clearly didn't want to necessarily take a side. But even ostensibly pro labor politicians like Todd Gloria didn't really want to be seen as on one side of it. And I think that might fit with what you're talking about, that the Republic sensed that there was some more patience here for the company to wait it out.
Yeah, I think that's fair. And the other thing that hampered the ability of the city to act more quickly, I mean, to begin with, they waited a few weeks before even doing anything because the strike happened right before the holidays. They could have called an emergency meeting, but they didn't. And I think they also probably assumed in their minds that this would be resolved in a few days. But when they finally sat down to talk about it and think about what their options would be, they realized that in their previous franchise agreement with Republic Services, they had excused the company from fault if there was a strike or a work stoppage. And I talked to the city attorney about this, and he told me that some franchise agreements with sanitation companies include that language, others don't. But what it did to Chula Vista was it meant that they couldn't come in and basically say, look, Republic Services, you're at fault for this. You need to get a deal done. Instead, they had to find other language and other potential legal leverage within their contract that they could execute. So instead, they started looking at, okay, well, can we fine Republic Services for just not doing its job? And its job is to just pick up trash regardless of whether or not there's a strike. So it became a more complicated legal question in Chula Vista than it did in, say, Huntington Beach.
So they had that initial $4.90 improvement to their wages over time, and then they kept holding out, but they didn't get much after that. They basically got a little bit of a bonus to come back to work, and what else?
They also got a 10 cent per hour increase to their pension contributions, which for some of the older guys was actually great. One guy who I spoke with who's nearing retirement thought that that was fantastic, but overall sort of disappointed in the rest of the package. It did also include increased allowances for certain pieces of equipment like boots and tools. The company provides a certain amount of money so those guys can buy the stuff that they need to literally go out on the job. Yeah.
I think one of the interesting parts about your story is just how it fits in this larger context, what's happening around the country, which is this workers, frankly, just appear to feel like they have a lot more leverage right now, and they're pushing for better arrangements, better contracts. There's more strikes. There's more all kinds of these just initiatives across the country.
Better job quality.
Yeah. You know. And I think in your piece, though, it seems like there was a reckoning in the piece of people saying, we're just not good at this, though, right now, right? Like, as far as they might be a little out of practice on holding the line on a strike.
Yeah, I think that's true. I think that, well, look, union membership has been declining for decades in the United States. And so we're certainly seeing a kind of resurgence in organizing and demonstrations. And then I think on top of that, the pandemic has revealed to people who don't work these types of jobs just how difficult they really are and how essential they are to keeping the entire system afloat. I think the union did everything it possibly could to hold everyone together for as long as possible. But I think all of these factors and all these pressures just built up. And the last couple of meetings that I went to seemed pretty anxious. And the guys just folded at the end of it. And so Republic Services got what they wanted just by waiting them out.
Well, you can follow Jesse's work with his new newsletter, Fine City. It's the column comes out every other week. You can subscribe at vosd.org/newsletters. Jesse, thanks for coming on.
Thanks, Scott.
I like that dude.
Jesse?
Yeah, he's good.
Cool.
Mm-hmm. He's okay.
He's still on the phone.
Oh. Hey, Jesse.
Hey, Jesse.
So, Lopez, last week you and I talked about these kind of startling comments from Mayor Todd Gloria in his State of the City speech about conservatorships. I just didn't expect him to say that one of the solutions he was going to employ was to put people in charge of other individuals' lives and, in many cases, remove their freedom to be on the streets. And I think he brought up something that a lot of us thought when we heard it, which is the Britney Spears situation.
the queen of pop.
I think it's fair to say millions of people learned what a conservatorship was from that news story. Now, I'm going to ask you this, put you on the spot, Andrea. Do you understand the difference between what she faced and what the plans and ideas are from Mayor Todd Gloria? So our own Lisa Halberstadt did some reporting this week and kind of got into that.
Yeah. So I think I do.
Okay. But
let's just explain what a conservatorship is in the first place. It's a legal arrangement usually done through court, through a judge, that appoints a representative for someone who, you know, has some kind of mental illness, dementia. They can't take care of themselves. So basically they appoint this representative to handle this person's medical care, finances, and sometimes just like basic life things like who they choose to marry, you know, just basic stuff. So that's essentially a conservatorship. But in California, there's two types of conservatorships. There's a probate, so think Britney Spears. But then there's one called a Lanterman Petras Short, basically LPS. And that's reserved for people who are gravely disabled. Think someone who can't feed themselves, can't find shelter, and can't clothe themselves. And that's what Gloria is talking about, not the kind that we know about because of Britney Spears.
Yeah. So Britney Spears is her whole affairs are being taken care of, but she can still like go out or something. But this is a situation where somebody's can't function and thus an individual is put in charge of their actual functioning, their health and everything.
Right.
Yeah, and so it's as Lisa reported for us this week, it's that legal standard, gravely disabled, that sets a really high threshold for when a city could intervene to take somebody off the street and put them into this conservatorship process and eventually have a judge put a conservator over them. And so like one of the advocates she spoke to referred to a specific situation in which a woman was trying to get her son off the street and she found him and saw him eating food out of the garbage can. And that was specifically cited as a reason that he couldn't be put into the conservatorship process because his eating food out of the garbage can was evidence that he could feed himself. Mm. And so that he was not gravely disabled because he wasn't going to starve if he was eating food out of a trash can.
Oh. And they want to change that.
They want to lower the threshold from gravely disabled so that more people who are severely mentally distressed and can't take care of themselves, but may not meet this really high bar of literally being in danger of dying any second, based on how disabled they are, lower that to a point that would capture more of the people who are living on the street.
And I thought that example was interesting because, I mean, I would think that his mom would argue that
that is evidence.
That is evidence that somebody needs help. Yes. Eating out of a trash can is not ideal.
Yes. And so it was actually used in exactly the opposite of what I think you might intuitively expect them to mean it for.
So one of the things I was surprised about that it was so prominent in the state of the city. Again, he's saying like, we can't accept the situation as it is. Here's the things we're doing. And this was probably the one he spent the most time kind of explaining. Mm-hmm. And then did we get a sense from that reporting about how much this could impact the situation on the streets?
Well, I think Lisa mentioned that this conversation is not something new to San Diego County. This conversation was had at a certain point, and county officials determined that based on the current threshold, only 8 people would be eligible for this.
Eight total in the county.
8 people.
Eight people would
based on the current threshold
would meet the standard of what you would need to prove.
Is that the county's own interpretation, or is that is in Canabi challenge, or is it just that the law really is that clear?
This was in discussion of like a pilot program, and it was that the county staff had done some work about like, okay, if this is the standard, here's how many people have been in and out of the system enough times to trigger a yes. They came up with 8. So it may not be 8, but I think it gives you an anchor for how low the number we're talking about for the availability of this function presently is. And they're attempting to increase it, yes. But my read from Lisa's reporting is we're not talking about a broadly powerful measure that would address the hundreds and hundreds of people who sleep on the streets of San Diego right now. It would be more than 8, but less than 1,000, you know? And so I think, and Todd Gloria, she spoke, Lisa interviewed Mayor Gloria, and he said to her, you know, this is an important tool for acute cases, and there are more of them than we're able to address right now. But he's not pitching this as a way of you know, clearing the streets of homeless people.
Mm. Well, this is really interesting to watch. It sounds like a lot of different legislators and the mayor and the governor are interested in this.
I mean, it certainly requires a balance. I mean, there are few things as powerful of intervention into people's civil rights than to take their ability to provide for themselves and make their own basic decisions away from them. So
yeah, it's the opposite of liberty.
It's the opposite of liberty. And I will say that the advocates who are pushing for this seem keenly aware of how important that balance is. That they just come down on the side that there are a number of people for whom it is cruel to leave to their own devices based on their present level of mental health. Mm-hmm.
I think what will be interesting just kind of, you know, to watch throughout this process is people's ability to differentiate between what I mentioned, probate, and then this LPS. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, there are, at the same time that the state is pushing for conservatorship, some people are pushing for reform because of what happened to Brittany. So I think it'll be interesting to see, you know, how that message is formed and if it gets tangled with that, because like we mentioned last week, we think of conservatorship and we think of Britney Spears.
Yeah, we don't often hear from Assemblyman Bryant Mainshine's office, but we did get an email this week from them because they're pushing a reform of the probate, the Britney Spears world, and they don't want to be mixed up with that they're trying to oppose or stand in the way of these efforts to liberalize the other type that might help with people who are struggling on the street. So there's just a lot of sensitivity about like, no, we're still in on this or not on that or how it's all going to work out. So I just think it's a fascinating push. I'm one of those things that kind of slipped under my radar that could become a bigger deal. Or maybe it's just another talking point. There was a really interesting column in the LA Times yesterday, Steve Lopez. I think other people, in there's a marriage race going on in LA. And I think his point was kind of like, we're sick of hearing the same points about homelessness. Like, what? Stop overpromising. Stop under-delivering. Stop saying the same things. Like, what are we, and it's there is that stasis. Just, what are we doing?
I feel that way often, where like in the last 10 years, this has gone from an issue that was present but not the dominant, not even close to the most dominant issue in public affairs, to the only thing that people really seem to talk about.
Every survey, every issue, it's always, this is the big, and he even said, Gloria said, this is the thing people talk to me about the most, overwhelmingly.
I mean, it's unavoidable. You see it everywhere you go. And I mean, to the thrust of this column was, we can't just keep having the same conversation, and I see no good reason to believe anything is changing, much less getting better. And I don't know that conservatorships are necessarily seen as like the skeleton key to clearing out the skid rows that have developed in multiple cities in this state. And in fact, it seems like Mayor Gloria is being quite careful to suggest that this is like a limited tool in its scope, but it's important still. But nonetheless, yes, the conversation and the sense of urgency around this needs to overcome the stasis that we've been in for the last 10 years.
Thanks for listening to the Voice of San Diego podcast, the most popular public affairs podcast recorded in the studio again. We're back. We've got a cool new product at Voice. We text you the news. You'll get exclusive info and updates on our biggest stories, all in quick and easy text messages. You can also ask us questions, give us story tips, and more. Sign up now at vosd.org/text. That's vosd.org/text. I'm Scott Lewis, CEO and Editor-in-Chief at Voice San Diego. Andrew Keats and Andrea Lopez Villafana are our managing editors. And Nate John is our esteemed producer. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week.